What I'd like to do is talk just a little bit about the idea of the Information Trust Association. In the PDF that I passed out, we talked about the origins of the RJI process. I want to talk a little bit about the critical challenge on the web that we see emerging today, which is one of trust and identity and information commerce. The web was really invented as an exercise of the Defense Department and academic researchers to allow communications in the event of a nuclear attack. And when the web, when the internet began, the notion of needing to know who was behind the computer wasn't really the priority concern, because if you were in the Defense Department, you could make the assumption that you weren't a hacker, you weren't a dog. It wasn't a dog on the other side of the computer screen, and so there really wasn't a protocol that emerged in the early days of the web that dealt with who's on the end of the computer. But now, as the web has become commerce enabled and has become a commercial and consumer vital commercial and consumer resource for the world, it's becoming fairly important to understand, in some circumstances, who's behind the computer. And so that notion of, can you trust who's at the other end of the computer in something as simple as a comment on an anonymous comment on a blog post, to something as complicated as you're logging into your banking interface, and are you really who you say you are? That's really a critical problem that hasn't been solved, and it's also critical to figuring out how are you going to be able to meter or charge for information or compensate people for looking at things on the web. So as we thought about that trust issue, we thought about some other comparables that I'll go through, and then started to think about the solution of the Information Trust Association. So the RJA process, which Roger talked about last night, is one of seeding ideas that then lead to experiments and research, and then solutions that hopefully sustain the values, principles, and purposes of journalism. So the screen that's applied in this institution in looking at potential fellowship proposals and the ongoing research that goes on here is kind of going through that process. And that's where we started with the Information Valet, with this key question of how do you sustain the values, principles, purposes of journalism. In an environment, as you can see, where things are splintering, classifieds have been kind of blown up as a business model, content's being atomized on the web, and what do you do? So we had an event actually called Blueprinting the Information Valet Economy in December of 2008, and I'm trying to remember, there's a few people in the room here that I think joined us for that, where we started to explore some of these questions. And that led to these research starting points, that less than 1% of time spent online is at daily newspaper websites, that the average newspaper site visitor spends about 1 minute per day on a site. Now, that's trending better as we get better and more sophisticated at managing newspaper websites, but there's also uncertainty about what's going to start to happen as tablets and mobile become a dominant method for consumers to interact with the web. So there are these challenges for the industry, and so we thought that we need to think through, well, what would be the elements of a new news ecosystem, one in which the terms publisher and broadcaster are somewhat anachronistic, because the key challenge for publishers today, or people formerly known as publishers, is not necessarily to aggregate a mass market audience and then serve undifferentiated information to that mass market audience. It may be more about developing customized one-to-one relationships with individual users on an automated basis, obviously, so that you can provide them the information they particularly need when they need it, customized to their needs, and also be able to provide customized sponsored information, writ advertising, and be able to get paid for doing that. And in this environment, which I call the gatekeeper to information valet environment, content has become atomized. It can be remixed and customized by the consumer. And so the notion of being able to have complete control of your package, as you did when you had a daily newspaper, or as you did when you had a magazine or a book, is becoming increasingly difficult. Now, it's interesting that the iPad in some ways is a countervailing force to that trend that's been really obvious over the last 10 years on the web, that trend of the consumer picking pieces apart and dealing with atomized content. Because you can see that publishers are really excited about the iPad, and Roger Fidler may talk a little bit about this at some point during the day, in that they can now get control of that package again and put together a really beautiful package. And it'll be interesting to see how that drive, that desire to package in the iPad and tablet environment is whether it overcomes or whether it is overcome by the consumer drive to want to get the content they want, when they want it, where they want it, from multiple different sources, that notion of atomized content. So I think another important trend that we're seeing is that of news as a service, not a product. In other words, those of you who are in the newspaper business are actually really not in the newspaper business anymore. The newspaper is merely one product extension, one product, one physical product manifestation of being in the information services business with a particular interest in timely news. And so if you start to think of yourself as a service provider rather than a product and rather than a manufacturer of a product, it may make it easier to envision new ways to serve the user, to help the user discover, access information from anywhere, to create a conversation and community, not just about the story, and to make it all very convenient and simple, and a set of value exchanges. In short, what I call the news social network, one built around trust. So in that news social network, people, we think, want trustworthiness, and that's a great check for the newspaper industry, because community newspapers still have enormous credibility in their community, and that's an important leverage point. The other thing that consumers want, another thing, is access to unfettered access to the information they need. If you think about how cable got started, cable was a solution to a problem of white noise in rural communities around America where they couldn't get any signal at all. And cable came in and said, $5 a month will give you a signal. And so suddenly people had something useful on their TV set that cleared away the white noise, cleared away the clutter. In a way, the web, you could make an analogy and say that the web in some ways, at least until search came along, the web was like white noise. It was very hard to find any channel, any information that's useful. And so search came along and helped solve that problem. But increasingly, the web keeps getting bigger, and it's almost starting to overwhelm general search. And so there's a huge opportunity to create services that clear the white noise. And just as cable found that they were able to charge for that, it seems to me logical that if you think of yourself as providing a service that clears the white noise, that may be a service that people are willing to pay for. Another key thing that consumers want is they want control over what we call their persona, the bits and pieces of information that are now spread all across the web with multiple logins and multiple passwords about who, you know, where you live, how old you are, what your information interests are, what your friends and who your friends are. And so we need to think about how we give consumers control over their identity in terms of privacy, in terms of their thinking about what their content is, and in terms of their personal interests. And then finally, consumers want value. And if you think about the continuum of the very first search engine that was out there was called InfoSeek. And Rick Lerner, my former colleague at ClickShare, will remember that the technology for InfoSeek was actually invented at the University of Massachusetts, my alma mater. And but that gave way to better search at Yahoo, which then in turn gave way to to pay, the page ranking methodology of Google. And so that value exchange keeps moving along a continuum as technology and ideas improve. Same thing with Flickr and YouTube as they get better and better. The same thing with MySpace being a pretty good idea in its time, but it eventually was supplanted by Facebook, which figured out a much better way to create a social experience than did MySpace. And in a way, you can see that transition from newspaper to iPad tablet. So I guess the message that I think about on this point is the idea that you've got to, today's value exchange isn't good enough for tomorrow, because the opportunities in the marketplace are continually changing. So the summary that we reached in the process of doing the Information Valet project was that one solution after the mass market was to create an intimate, personalized, customized, permission-based relationship that was between the consumer and their information valet, their most trusted service provider. That whether the consumer is part of a mass market is almost irrelevant to whether you can create a value proposition that works for them. And that we think that the core opportunity is to make money providing a service, not just, and maybe not even, content. So that the idea of owning content isn't necessarily as important as providing the ability to help people find content from anywhere. Or as I said in 95 when I started thinking about some of these issues, to find a way to help newspapers learn how to make money referring people to information from anywhere. And in that environment, the notion of a paywall as a term becomes almost an oxymoron, because in a perfect service relationship with the consumer moves seamlessly in and out of what I call the unwalled garden, from a place where the information is curated and sorted and found for them, into the wild west, the white noise of the web. And they can go out into the forest when they want to be in the forest. They can come back into the garden when they want to be in the garden. And the technology, whatever it is that we in meetings like this start to think about creating or using, has to make that garden seem like it's not behind a wall. It just needs to be seen as so appealing in terms of the way the plants are laid out and the way the pathways move beautifully through a well laid out garden, that's so appealing to people that they move into that garden and out of the garden seamlessly. So in thinking about how do you create that infrastructure that is universal to the web, in the same way that HTTP is, in the same way that other protocols that exist today on the web, it's useful to think about other analogies in other industries. For example, when you go and buy an extension cord at a hardware store, you're likely to look on it and see if it has a little UL circle of approval, which says that Underwriters Labs in Chicago or wherever they are have tested it and made sure it met some basic safety requirements. So that's one example of an industry collaborating in a way that has nothing to do with pricing or servicing or competition. It's around creating an important consumer benefit. That is to say, hey, this is a product that I know is not going to create a fire in my house. You might think about the Bluetooth Association, which some of you may not be familiar with, but the way your earbud communicates with your cell phone, or the way your computer communicates with a wireless keyboard, is the Bluetooth protocol, which is a very complicated set of rules and regulations about how wireless radio devices handshake with and connect with each other. Well, there were multiple companies that had patents in that area, and they were all competing just the way Betamax and the other format for cassette players were competing, and the industry, with proper antitrust with appropriate advice for antitrust oversight, formed a nonprofit association which shared, cross-licensed all of those rights and developed protocols so that there's still competition over how much you pay for your earbud and the forms and features of it, but at least one earbud knows how to connect with the same computer as another earbud does. So that's another example. The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, the core entity that runs the root servers on the Internet that makes sure that when you type in circlabs.com or rjionline.org that it actually goes to the right place and that that's uniform and propagated across the net. That's another example. Think about the fact that when railroads got started, some of them had different gauge railroads and they all had to come to a standard. Now the standard in this country is different from the standard in Europe. But at least on this continent, if you've got a boxcar, you can build the wheels the same width apart and run it across the rails all across the country. The National Automated Clearinghouse Association is an affiliation of banks that make it possible for you to do electronic funds transfers and electronic bill paying by establishing standards there. So the Associated Press, I mean, is another example of a cooperative formed in the 1800s because newspapers had a problem. They couldn't. There wasn't enough bandwidth on the teletype. On the teletype to be able to get reports from the battlefield in the Civil War, there wasn't enough bandwidth. So they pooled and got single factual reports that they then embellished into their individual news stories. So again, another example of competitors coming together in a consumer appropriate way to solve a problem to fix something that's broken that makes something not consumer usable. The last story I'd like to tell about that kind of industry collaboration is Visa, Bank of America, and a guy named Dee Hock. Does anybody know the name Dee Hock? Okay. Dee Hock is a guy who was head of a small bank in Washington State in the 60s, who his bank was working with Bank of America when Bank of America had a card called the Bank AmeriCard. Did anybody ever have a Bank AmeriCard? Okay. That was owned by Bank of America. Bank of America said to Dee Hock, "We're having a real problem. We have all these correspondent banks around the country who we're trying to get to carry the Bank of America card. And they don't want to do it because they're perceiving the Bank AmeriCard as our brand. And they're afraid that if they promote our brand, some of those people are going to start becoming Bank of America customers instead of the local bank's customer." And Dee Hock said, "Well, you know what you guys have to do? Instead of trying to turn Bank AmeriCard into the credit card standard for the nation, why don't you profit by giving it away? Why don't you form a nonprofit, Visa International Service Association, and share the ownership of that association with hundreds and hundreds of corresponding banks that you've been doing business with. And let's make up a new brand that's not associated with Bank of America. Let's call it Visa." And that became the most phenomenally successful network for the exchange of value in the history of the planet. And it spawned a competitor with the same model, MasterCard, and it completely overtook the American Express model, which was, if you have an American Express card, your account is with an American Express. If you have Visa or MasterCard, your account is with whichever bank you signed up with. It's not with Visa or MasterCard. That's an acceptance brand. It's the wholesale in the background. So I think that's one of the most fascinating examples, I think, of taking a situation where nobody was winning. I mean, Bank of America wasn't winning. The consumer wasn't winning, the correspondent banks weren't winning, and turning it into a new idea, a new network where everybody ended up winning. Well, now today you might say consumers aren't winning, but I mean in terms of the ubiquity of a card that works anywhere practically on the planet, in terms of the convenience and trustworthiness of that system, unbeatable. So those are some examples of why collective action appropriately within the bounds of antitrust laws to solve a problem that creates instant convenience and trust for the consumer and the ability for commercial players to make money is really important. So what, and I have to say here, I don't, I want to say that this isn't necessarily RJI's idea. This is a thought experiment, okay? And the thought experiment that I'd like us all to be thinking about in the next couple of days is the idea of forming something called the Information Trust Association. And you can see the convening principle that we've drafted and fiddled around with. A nonprofit association to lead creation of a free market for digital information. It builds on standards, ensures consumer choice and trust, enables price and service competition. It is broadly and openly governed with a global perspective. The operations it sanctions first benefit journalism, democracy, and freedom ahead of private interest. The potential roles for the ITA to sustain journalism's values, principles, and purposes, to establish voluntary privacy, trust, and identity standards, to research, test, and commission key technologies, to sanction protocols for sharing users and content, to direct multi-site user authentication services, and to enable consumer choice for commerce and privacy with the possibility of one account, one bill, one ID, purchase anywhere capabilities, but no single owner of all the users. So those are some of the roles that strike me as relevant and appropriate for an organization like this. There may be many more, and some of these may, for some reason, be not appropriate. Getting into the nitty-gritty, and I should wrap up in the next minute or so because I think Bill needs a little time to talk about the history of the ANDEC, is that it be a nonprofit that potentially and initially work with RJI here at Mizzou as its sort of logistical sponsor. We've developed ideas for board composition, and here what we see is some of the results and benefits: enabling web-wide micro accounting and subscriptions, supporting the atomization of content, where you can send one of your consumers to content all over the web, and if it's being tracked from the point of view of an event that somebody looked at a piece of content at multiple sites, then you're going to be able to get compensated for that. So I'm going to wrap it up here. Encourage you to look at the handout. This will be on the web. It isn't right now, but will be a little bit later at that URL you see in blue there, www.newshare.com/ita.pdf. And I'll stop there. And I hope this has incited a lot of questions, but I think the time to handle those questions would be in the afternoon or later this morning. So I'm going to turn the floor over to Bill now, and so that he can kind of warm us up for the beginning of the...
Yeah, now for